2012, February 27th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 36, Strange New Worlds, the Properties of Exoplanets. So on Friday, we talked about how we search for planets around other stars. Today is going to be to describe what the results have been so far. So today we're going to be looking at some of the very strange new worlds that we've discovered through our searches for exoplanets. Yeah, and I see I got the wrong slide. Okay, should say, this is 405 up there. That should be 760 planets are known. Until I was updating an old lecture and I missed a number. Most of these have been discovered by the radial velocity and transit methods. We'll go into some detail on that in just a second. There have been a number of surprises. We're going to meet hot Jupiters, which are giant gas planets, which are really close to their parent stars. This was the number one big surprise with a bullet for the whole program of finding exoplanets. It was just not what we were expecting. Many of the planets that we find are not on nearly circular orbits like we see in our solar system, but in fact are quite eccentric. They're very elliptical. And there's going to be some interesting puzzles behind that, although in fact these two things, hot Jupiters and eccentric Jupiters, are related. In fact, they're related through this problem of planetary migration, the fact that planets don't end up where they were born. They actually dynamically move in because solar systems are dynamically active places. And what we're seeing is the effects of this dynamic activity in other solar systems, but also our experiments are very sensitive to finding these planets. The other thing is that our current techniques are, at this point, mostly but not completely biased against finding planets like our own systems. But that is starting to change, and at the end of the class, I'll be presenting some results from the Kepler mission, which is the part of that starting to change part of searching for exoplanets around other stars. So our goal today is to try to look at what the results are for finding planets around other stars. Now it's a proper up-to-date slide. To date, and to date here means as of a couple of weeks ago, on Valentine's Day was the last day that the exoplanet database was updated. We have a catalog now of 760 planets around 609 stars that have been discovered by a variety of methods that we discussed on Friday. Here's the breakdown. You don't need to memorize this, but it gives you an idea of the numbers. 469 of these planets have been found using the radial velocity, the Doppler wobble method. Another 230 by the transiting planets method. So this RV method and planetary transit method is the number one way to find exoplanet systems in the current time. 31 have been seen by taking direct images. You take a picture of the star and you can actually see the planets outside the glare of the star. That's a new and emerging technique. 14 have been found through this technique of gravitational microlensing that was pioneered here at Ohio State. And finally, another 16 were found by pulsar timing. We haven't talked about pulsars in this class. Just very briefly, what a pulsar is a rapidly rotating magnetized neutron star. It's the leftover from a star that's gone supernova. What we're probably seeing in this case is either A, remnant cores of a surrounding system, or material that has fallen back after the star has exploded and formed into a secondary planetary system. These are weird. We're not going to talk about them anymore because these are not a place for life, because pulsars are probably one of the nastiest X-ray environments in the entire galaxy. End of discussion. The other thing that's come out of this discovery of planets is you might notice a mismatch between the total number of planets and the number of their parent stars. That tells you a lot of these systems are now multi-planet systems. These used to be oddballs. There are now 100 multi-planet systems known. Most of those are 2- and 3-planet systems, but we've only recently, in the last year, gotten a 6-planet system. Remembering we are an 8-planet system, so we're really starting to creep in on things that roughly resemble our solar system, but in detail they do not. This is a planetary system called Kepler's 11. It's a G6 star, which is a slightly cooler star from our sun. It has a system of 6 planets, 3 or 4 of which are actually Jupiter-mass planets, and you get a couple of super-Earths and Neptune-sized things running around in here. These things are all in real close. This is a pretty weird system. This is not very much not like our solar system. It's a pretty cool system altogether. So far, in fact, what we found is we found very few systems that even come close to resembling our solar system, with gas giant planets at about 5 or 10 AUs from the sun, and rocky planets on the inside. We're getting close. We found one for sure solar system analog. But things that even come close to having Jupiter's and Earth-like or Earth or super-Earth planets in about the right zone for terrestrial and gas planets have been kind of elusive so far. Now, there are reasons for that, as we'll see here in just a moment. Well, first of all, let's take a look at one of the surprises. One of the big surprises was these Jupiter planets are everywhere. These are the first planets we expect to find, because remember, what we're looking for in these Doppler wobble, or so-called RV methods, or the transiting methods, is either the reflex motion of the parent star due to the orbital motion of a nearby planet. The bigger the planet, the bigger the reflex motion, the easier it is to see. If it's a transiting planet, the bigger the planet that's blocking the star, the deeper the dip it makes when it moves between us and the star, the easier it is to see. So both the RV and the transit methods are biased towards finding big planets. Furthermore, the closer that planet is to its parent star, the larger both effects. So we have a built-in bias to finding big things close to their parent stars. Over time, we become increasingly sensitive to small things close in, or small or larger things further away. Further away means we have to wait more time between eclipses or wobbles, so you've got to kind of run the experiment for 10 or 20 years before you actually get a good signal. That was why the very first planet we discovered around another more or less sun-like star, 51 Pegasi b, was such a shocker when it happened. It's a half a Jupiter planet, only 0.05 of an astronomical unit from its parent star. It has a very nice, very big radial velocity signature. It's in a nearly circular orbit. It has a 4.25 day period, very close in, and it's a gas giant like Jupiter. So what the heck is a gas giant doing so close to its parent star? That was the big surprise. If we look out in our solar system, the gas giants are way out past something called the ice line. That's the place in our solar system where stable ices can exist. And that ice line in our solar system today is about 3 astronomical units out. That's a long, long ways from 0.05. So this was a big surprise. Now, in some sense, we should not have been surprised, because our methods were most sensitive to finding these first oddball systems. But what's been kind of bothersome is how many there are. So this is an artist's impression of 51 Pegasi b. 51 Pegasi is only 10 stellar radii away from its parent. That's what 0.05 astronomical units means. Unfortunately, the way they've drawn this particular picture, it looks like it's about 2 and change stellar radii away, but that's because the artist did their best. Maybe we're seeing this thing in distant perspective profile. But that's what these planets are going to be like. They're up close and personal to their parent stars. Many of them will have one face always locked towards the parent star. These are really, really strange configurations. That's why I refer to this lecture by ripping off that line from Star Trek, Strange New Worlds. These really were not what we were expecting to see or see in abundance when we started looking for planetary systems back 30, 40 years ago. Here's just a selection of some of these multi-planet systems. To give you a perspective where they are, in the very bottom row, first of all, let's go up the vertical axis. That is the parent star drawn to scale with the size of the planets. And then along the horizontal axis is the distance of those planets from their parent star. Now here we've drawn it not as a linear axis, but as a logarithmic axis. So each big tick here is a tenth of an AU, that's where the Earth would be, 10 AUs, and 100 AUs. So there's Jupiter and Saturn, Uranus and Neptune, and they didn't bother plotting the internal terrestrial planets. These are a selection of some of these other planetary systems, including this one right here, Ogle 2006-109L, which is this Jupiter-Saturn analog system that we discovered at Ohio State back in 2007. It's got a Jupiter and a Saturn at about the right position for its parent star. Its parent star is lower mass. That moves the ice line further in, and so those planets are there. The rest of these, however, a couple of these here, like 47 Yuma and 14 Her, those are kind of getting like it, but those are really big planets. Those are multi-Jupiters. And in fact, we see an awful lot of super-Jupiters and an awful lot of Neptune and other sized planets really close to their parent stars. So this kind of laid out in this this way of looking at it shows you how really oddball some of these systems look. There's some very big Jupiter, very big gas planets in here. Again, it shouldn't be surprising. We're very, very sensitive to the bigger planets because they make a bigger Doppler wobble signal. They have a bigger radial velocity signature. Some of these things will also make big transit signatures as well, so they're the easiest to find. So part of this is this real surprise, finding a lot of gas giants inside the ice line. I'm going to show a different version of this plot later, and I'll make that point a little bit more clearly. The other thing we found in the studies of planets, and this is a little bit of an old plot. I couldn't find an updated one with all 760 numbers on it. So this is actually a couple of years old. The newer ones were just uninterpretable. They were so messy. Is the properties that we found for these exoplanet systems show a tremendous amount of diversity. It isn't just little models of our solar system. The planet masses we've found so far range from getting down to about the mass of the Earth up to about 13 or 14 times the mass of Jupiter. The orbital semi-major axes, how far away their orbits are from their central star, range from 2% of an astronomical unit out to about 8 to 10 astronomical units. And we're starting to break into the kind of 10-plus astronomical units now. The other big surprise was the orbital eccentricity. An eccentricity of 0 means a circular orbit. The orbits of most of the planets in our solar system are very close to 0. They're small. The biggest eccentricities are a couple tenths for something like Mercury. But these things were getting up to 93%. That's like a comet. Things go in and go way out, and they come really in. So this eccentricity was really surprising. That was not expected. The host star masses range from down to about, getting into the top, lower end of K-dwarfs, up to about A-stars. Now, lately, this number has been dropping, and we're starting to get things down below a tenth or even less for M-dwarfs. But this particular plot's older, so there aren't any of those M-dwarf points on this plot. And finally, the distances of these planets from us range from the nearest at about around 10 light years, so just kind of in the backyard, all the way out to 21,000 light years for some of the planets that we've been finding in or near the galactic bulge of our own galaxy using the microlensing technique. So there's a lot of diversity in here. And you can see sort of all the planets tend to be crowding so far up into this upper corner, which are very close to their parent star and very, very massive. To put it in perspective, there's Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and then Earth, Venus, and Mars. Now this plot has begun to be filled in lately with brand new data. Like I said, unfortunately, I just looked for a couple days and could not find a modern version of this. But we're slowly but surely beginning to creep up on Earth, Venus, and Mars size. We're just starting to crack that boundary there, but not just yet. But we've got a lot of really big gas giants pretty close in. And again, the reason for that is the sensitivities of the experiments. So let's recap some of these things. Surprise number one, as I've been saying all along, is how many of these Jupiters are within 5 astronomical units of their parent star. That was not expected. The orbital periods tend to be really short, a few days, usually less than 10 days. If they put such planets inside our solar system, they would be inside the orbit of Mercury. However, when we can measure the densities of these planets, and we do this through those that transit, when a planet transits, we know exactly how much of the star it's blotting out, and that gives us immediately a measurement of the planet's density. We know what kind of materials it's made of. And what we find when we've done that is we find Jupiter and Saturn-like densities. We find things that are puffy and floatable like Saturn or much more dense like Jupiter. That tells us we're not dealing with big rocky planets. We're really dealing with gas giants. So this isn't just an accident that we found some unusually big rock balls. These really are gas balls. Now, part of the explanation for this is that it is a selection effect. A selection effect is where you're taking a sample of stars. You're looking for planets around those stars, but your methods are biased. Your methods are more sensitive to certain types of planets than others. Let's take, for example, finding a Jupiter. If a Jupiter goes in a 10-day orbit, I will very quickly see that wobble signature. Within a few months, a couple months of observing, I will pick up a couple of orbits worth of that planet very quickly. As a consequence of that, I'm going to be very sensitive. I have a nice confirmation in a short time. If I wanted to see a Jupiter in a Jupiter-like orbit around a Sun-like star, one orbit takes 11.2 years. So to see at least one and maybe two confirmatory cycles takes me 22 years. So if your experiment's only been running for 5, 6, 8, 10 years, you're only just now starting to see one full cycle for Jupiters in a Jupiter-like orbit. So that's an example of a selection effect. The first ones you find and confirm are going to be the close-in ones with short periods, where within the course of a couple of years, you can measure a complete orbit or two. That's why you want to confirm things. There's a lot of wacky things that happen dynamically among stars. You want to confirm that it really is a repeating radial velocity pattern. Or you want to see that eclipse happen more than once. You don't just say, eclipse, woohoo, planet. There's all kinds of false positives and other stuff. You've got to really work hard to confirm. Not surprisingly, the first ones to confirm are the ones that repeat more often. The ones that take a year, 2 years, 3 years, takes you a lot longer to get all the confirmatory data before you say, aha, planet, and put it up on the list. So that's an example of selection effects. So that's part of what we're seeing here. But the other problem is this. Even if we take into account the selection effects, why are all those Jupiters so close to their stars? They shouldn't be able to form there. The only way you can build a Jupiter-sized core that we know of is by layering on ices. And once you get enough ices and rock in one core to get above about 10 times the mass of the Earth, then your gravity gets strong enough to begin to gather up hydrogen. Well, remember back that plot we used to show a lot in earlier lectures, where your ability to retain an atmosphere depended on two things: your escape speed, how big, how massive you are, and how hot you were. Well, if you put a 10 solar mass core up at 0.05 astronomical units, 10 stellar radii away from its parent star, it's got plenty of gravity, but it's way too hot to hold on to hydrogen. It can't form there. It can't build the initial atmosphere. Once you build that atmosphere, you can kind of hang on to it once you get above a certain mass. But that's because you've got to build that big, heavy atmosphere first to build the big gravity. If you're further away in the solar system, out beyond what we call the ice line, A, you can build that big core really fast by accumulating ices. And B, the gases are colder, so it's easier to hold on to them at that initial smaller phase, and then you grow very rapidly. So all of our notions about how planets form tell us these things do not form here. So the question is, how did they get there? And the answer is, we're going to come back to that. But that's the mystery. That's what they're doing there. That's why they shouldn't be there. They stand out as being weird. One of the things we can piece together when we get a transit, and we're getting a few hundred transits now, so we're getting a lot more data on this, and even this plot is relatively old. That's because the people who are doing this work are right now beating their brains out on the Kepler data, because there's, well, quite frankly, there's an awful lot of Kepler data, and it's just starting to come out. So this is a relatively recent plot. This is about a year old now. This is actually a few months old now, because I just noticed Kepler 11F is there. This is a plot where we look at the radius of the planet as a function of the mass of the planet in masses of the Earth. So to put it in perspective, Earth and Venus are down here. They have one Earth radii, and they're about an Earth mass. They're also very dense. Remember that the Earth and Venus are made of rock for the most part. And this red line shows you where you would be if you were a rocky planet. This takes into account that when you pile up rock, it compresses in a certain way and it pushes back and reaches an equilibrium. So if I had a pure iron core, as you increase the mass of the iron core, it would come up to a certain maximum size. If I put rock on top of that iron core, I get a pattern like this, where if I punch 100 times the mass of the Earth, I don't get 100 times bigger because the stuff compresses and reaches an equilibrium at a smaller size. Just for fun, you can make a pure water world, and you get compression there as well. And then finally, the yellow line is how a big Jupiter gas bag type of atmosphere grows. And you notice it grows very rapidly in mass and size. They're puffy, but they too are subject to the laws of gas pressure, and so they reach a certain maximum size. So if you plot the radius and the mass of the planet, it will plop down on this diagram by what its internal composition is. Pure hydrogen envelopes will lie more or less near the golden line here. A pure rock world will fall near the red line. And sure enough, what you expect is Venus and Earth are rocky planets. They fall right on the rock line. Jupiter and Saturn fall close to this red line. Now, really, these are bands, but just to make it clear, they draw sort of the central ridge line. And what we see is that for those planets for which we've gotten the information, most are gas giants. And what's interesting is some of them are very big for their mass compared to a Jupiter or Saturn. These are puffy. They're actually lower density. They're big puffballs. Part of that may have to do with their being very close to their parent star. The additional heating and the action of tides is thought to make these things puff up a bit. They don't have a small size like they would if they were far out in the solar system like Jupiter and Saturn. So we can actually get some interesting insight into these planets just from these data. There have been a few intermediate objects that are like halfway between water ices and rock and hydrogen. Those two green stars are Uranus and Neptune. They're ice giants. So the ice giants are here, the rocky terrestrials are here, and the gas giants are up there. And sure enough, we've begun to pick up an increasing number of ice giants among these planets. So we've got a lot of gas giants, a lot of ice giants, and then a handful of rocky, what are called super-Earths. These things are getting up to, let's see, there's 4, 5, 6, and 7 times the mass of the Earth. But they're made of rock, so they're relatively small. There's just a small handful of these. 55 Cancri E, for example, is down here. It's about 8.5 Earth masses. And it's a gigantic, we think, a gigantic rock ball. And we haven't found any super-duper Earths out here. You probably can't make those. If you built up a core beyond about 10 or 11 times the mass of the Earth and there's any hydrogen around, they start soaking up the hydrogen and they either become ice giants or gas giants. So there is sort of a maximum size we expect for the super-Earths. This picture is now starting to get filled in more down here by the Kepler planets. Here's a close-up of this region down here, but filling in some of the recent Kepler planets. These three points down here are Kepler-10, Corot-7, and Kepler-11b. There's 55 Cancri. There's Earth and Venus down here. And now you're getting sort of, 50% water, Earth-like, maximum iron core, things like that are in these models and various bits here. And you're starting to see that we're starting to pick up things that are looking structurally like Earth-like planets, Earth-like compositions, iron core, rocky surroundings, but they're pretty hefty. They're getting up around 4 or 5 times the mass of the Earth. So these are super-Earths. These things up here, which are more massive than Jupiter, are super-Jupiters by the comparison. So this is a very nice, quick summary of the kind of properties of the planets we're finding. We're just starting to sneak up on mass of the Earth in the last few weeks, but those still have not been confirmed fully, because all we can measure is the size. We can't measure the mass yet. Once we have masses for some of those planets, they're going to get dropped down onto this diagram. Measuring masses is really, really, really hard in astronomy, so it's going to be a while before we begin to populate the candidate Earth mass planets down in here. So there's sort of a quick summary about the surprises. Lots and lots of Jupiters, a lot of them really close to their stars. One of the consequences of being close to your parent stars is you get big and puffy. Starting to see some ice giants and just starting to pick up the super-Earths. Surprise number two were the orbits of these planets. One would have expected, if you're going to be pretty close to your parent star, tides would have circularized you a long time ago. In fact, if we look at our own solar system, the 8 major planets all have roughly circular orbits. Mercury's a little bit elliptical, but Mercury's kind of weird. So is Mars a little bit. But they're not radically elliptical. What was surprising about these, especially for the Jovian planets in our solar system, are just about as close to circular orbits as you can get. But in these systems, the orbital eccentricities were very, very high. In fact, Jupiter-sized planets on elliptical orbits were really, really common. Some of these things are pretty radical. They're getting up to the ellipticities of comets, things that spend most of their time way out in the solar system and then plunge in towards the sun. That just plain wasn't expected. This is another way of looking at that. We're going to unwrap the orbit. So I plotted the average orbital distance here along the x-axis. This is actually a picture from your book. It's a couple of years old, but it does the job. The new plots have got so many points on them, they're kind of a mess. I tried to make a new one. It didn't work. And the orbital eccentricity, where 0 is a perfectly circular orbit, and 1.0 is basically an escape breakout orbit. So that's the limitation of eccentricity between 0 and 1. And we see things like Jupiter and Saturn. I mean, they're not perfectly circular, but they're pretty close. Uranus, Neptune's pretty close to circular. Venus and the Earth, again, slight ellipticity on the Earth, not so much on Venus. Mercury is up here about 0.22 eccentricity. Pluto is way up in here somewhere, but we don't talk about Pluto anymore. It's no longer a planet. And then you see all the red dots are various of the exoplanets found up to about 2007. And you see some things that are getting right up into Halley's Comet kind of eccentricities. Again, totally unexpected, probably has an explanation in the dynamics of the evolution of these solar systems. So, number one, what are all the hot Jupiters doing there? That needs explanation. They couldn't have formed there. And two, why do these hot, a lot of hot Jupiters have really eccentric elliptical orbits? Final piece of information that we've gotten from these things is that there's a tendency of the planets to be found around stars which have a lot of metal content. Now, we haven't talked too much about metals in the universe. We're talking about hydrogen and helium, but remember, rocky planets and the cores of gas giants are made out of rock and ice. They're made out of heavy elements. We're going to use as a stand-in for elements heavier than hydrogen, helium, iron. There's a good reason for doing that in the way that elements are produced inside of supernovae that makes this sensible. If you end up with a large iron to hydrogen ratio, that means you've got a very large proportion of metal relative to hydrogen. A small iron to hydrogen ratio is a small proportion of metals to hydrogen. It's kind of a roughly logarithmic scale, but we're not going to worry about that. Low metals, rich in metals. Or metal poor, metal rich. Oops. So what we get is the sun is kind of always our standard for measuring everything. It's got an Fe upon H of 0. That means a sun-like mix. Positive numbers is supersolar. Negative numbers is subsolar. And what we see is we get the frequency of which planets occurring goes up dramatically as we get to solar and supersolar metallicities. In some sense, this makes sense. You're going to build planets out of heavy elements. You've got to have heavy elements to build them out of. Sounds circular, but it seems shouldn't be plausible. A metal-poor star is not going to have a lot of raw materials to build planets out of, so planets should be more rare around those. Where when you get to the metal-rich stars, a lot more raw materials, a lot more planets can be constructed. So this is probably one of those results from exoplanet studies that really wasn't that surprising and kind of made sense. So what have we gotten so far? Well, the basic summary is this. What we've learned so far is that a lot of the solar systems that we found around other stars really don't look an awful lot like our solar system. They have these really hard to explain orbital eccentricities. Our solar system is nearly circular orbits. Some of these things have really eccentric orbits. There are Jupiter-sized planets really, really close to their parent stars. That just doesn't look like our solar system at all. In fact, they're way inside this ice line where you cannot even understand how they form. So what the heck is going on here? Well, let me show this plot in a different... Let me show that result, that these things are inside their ice line, by showing you this plot. This is this planet mass distance from the star plot. But we've replotted it, so instead of saying how far it is in astronomical units from the star, we've taken the brightness of the star and said, where is the snow line? Where is the ice line for these stars? For a low mass, low luminosity star, the ice line will be really close. For a hot star, the ice line is further away because the star is more luminous. You've been kind of working some of those problems over the last few problem sets on what are equilibrium temperatures as a function of distance from the star or as a function of luminosity of the star. Now you're seeing the payoff for that. You understand where this comes from. So here's the snow line, plotted as this blue line here. Everything beyond the snow line is where you can get ices condense out onto a rocky surface. Inside the snow line, the ices evaporate or sublimate, is a better way to put it. So what we find is Venus and Earth are inside the snow line. That's not surprising. They were not born with a lot of volatile ices. Those ices had to come from the outside and build our oceans through comet impacts. Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, J, S, U, and N, are beyond the snow line. They're heavy in ices. They're heavy in gases. That's what our solar system looks like. The various circles, the open circles, the red circles are radial velocity planets. The diamonds are these, or the triangles, excuse me, are these close-in transiting planets. This, again, this plot's a couple years old, so we should be filling in some of the spots down here are predominantly inside the snow line. Only a handful of planets really live outside the snow line. Part of this is a reflection of, as I mentioned before, these selection effects, that we're really more sensitive to the close-in planets, and we're just sort of, every year, we fill in more and more of the distant planets. But we are starting to find now planets which are outside their snow line. I'll call attention to the fact that astrometry, this is direct imaging, and these green hexagons, microlensing, you'll notice that those planets are all outside their snow line. This is an important point about how we search for planets. It's true that radial velocities and transit methods have produced far, far more planets than any other method. But they have a selection bias of being biased against finding close-in hot planets. Microlensing and direct astrometry, direct imaging, actually gives us an edge for finding more distant planets out beyond their ice line. That's why we start to suspect, in fact, one of the planetary systems out in this group here is Ogle 2006-109L, which is the first solar system analog that was found. It was found by microlensing. This is my point about there being direct imaging and astrometry of the stars and the squares, the hexagons, is we need more than one technique to search for planets. The radial velocity and transit methods, well, transit methods are always going to have a hard time because you've got to be kind of close to your star to have a chance of eclipsing it. Whereas if you're radial velocities, you've got to wait a long time. Microlensing, direct imaging, and astrometry will show them to you now. So RV methods and transits are sensitive for the most part inside the snow line. Radial velocities slowly encroach beyond the snow line. But the microlensing, direct imaging, and astrometry methods are sensitive to the beyond the snow line. So where we're going to find our solar system analogs, the reason why they're so rare is we haven't been looking for them. We've been looking for things that are not like our solar system. Our methods are sensitive to that. And it's only these new methods, transits, direct imaging, and astrometry, microlensing, direct imaging, and astrometry, that are really becoming sensitive to solar system-like analogs. This is, in fact, the first solar system analog. This is our solar system laid out to scale, and this is the Ogle 2006-109L system. It has a gas giant planet and a Saturn mass planet in about the same position that Jupiter and Saturn are relative to their parent star. Their parent star is a little bit fainter, so the ice line moves in proportionally. This one was a really, really big surprise when we discovered this about in late 2007. And the reason is because it was so close to our own solar system. This is the first and still so far only true solar system analog. A pair of gas giants where they should be. We expect we're going to be finding more over the years. Our techniques are not as efficient as radial velocities and transits, but we're starting to pick up a few more examples of these things, onesies and twosies. So this is the solar system analog is kind of the thing we're seeking. Now, you notice we put question marks on the inside and outside. The microlensing methods are only right now sensitive to the biggest mass planets, but they are starting to sneak up on the point where they can be sensitive to the low-mass Earth, Mars, Venus-type planets. That's technique coming in probably about 5-10 years. We're working on it, but it's going to take us some time and development of technique to get there. Now, here's this question. What are these Jupiters doing so close to their stars? Well, here's one of the ideas. The idea is that they didn't form there. They formed further out in their stellar systems and then migrated inward through the dynamical action of the gravity acting between the newly formed gas giant and the disk of gas and crud that they formed out of. It's a process called planetary migration. It actually seems to work pretty well. I can explain some of these things. What happens is you've got a planet, big gas giant, grows above a certain size with ices way out beyond its ice line, grows above 10 times the mass of the Earth, and all of a sudden now becomes able to hold on to a heavy hydrogen atmosphere. And this disk of gas and junk around that the star formed out of is really rich in hydrogen. So now instead of using only the rare ices and rock, which is a small fraction of the composition to build your planet, it's all of a sudden now you can access hydrogen as one of your construction materials, and you grow really, really fast. That's how you go from something 10 times the mass of the Earth to 300 times the mass of the Earth, like Jupiter. Most of the mass of Jupiter is that big hydrogen gas envelope. Well, when you hoover up the gas, you open up a big gap in that disk of junk. And you end up with a massive disk inside of you and a massive disk outside of you. If this disk is big enough, the gravity from that disk material tugging on the planet can actually rob it of orbital energy, and the planet will slowly spiral in. It will spiral in until it reaches the point that you get so far inside the snow line, it can no longer grab gas, and the gas, in fact, begins to thin out on the inside of the disk. And so you basically hoover your way in, and dump, you run out of material, and you stop where the migration ended. And that could be extremely close to the parent star. Does this explain all of the systems? No, not yet. But there are many different ways in which you can do the migration. For example, if you had two planets in the system, they can gravitationally interact and move things around. We see that in a smaller scale in our own planetary system. We saw very briefly that the asteroids and the Kuiper Belt objects are pushed into certain bands. They're pushed there because Jupiter slowly migrated a little bit towards the Sun, and Neptune pushed a little bit outwards. And it sculpted the orbits of the asteroids, in the case of Jupiter, and the Kuiper Belt and the ice balls, in the case of Neptune. But it never really was so great of a dynamical interaction that it caused Jupiter to move in close to the Sun. That's good for us, because if we, the Earth, were in the way on a massively migrating Jupiter, we would either be tossed into the Sun or tossed out of the solar system by this 800-pound gorilla of a planet working its way through gravitationally. So the presence of these really big gas giants very close to their stars is a sign of what we call dynamical evolution in the formation of these systems. We don't yet have a good idea of what makes it such that you form a system like our own, where Jupiter and Saturn kind of stay pretty close to where they were born, or that they move in. It may have something to do with the mass, the size of the disk of gas and dust that you were made out of, but there seem to be some other factors that come into play. That's why it's a very active area of research to kind of understand how migration works. This is kind of a bummer from the point of view of looking for Earth-like planets around stars, because if they've got a giant Jupiter really close, they probably destroyed whatever terrestrial planets formed in that system. So they may be a signpost of other worlds, but they may also be a destroyer of the terrestrial worlds that we would hopefully be the places we'd look for life. Now, it isn't a rule out that there might not be moons around these things that can harbor life, but it kind of changes the game again. So this idea of migration probably explains the hot Jupiters. Now, all the planet searches we've been talking about to this point, as I've said before, there's a big selection effect coming into play. We're sensitive to the most massive planets because they have the biggest radial velocity signature, and we're sensitive to planets which are very close into their parent stars because they have the biggest signature. So this is kind of the, if you will, the mass grade curve. Looks an awful lot like a grade curve from a few weeks ago. You get a big peak and a long tail towards small masses. And again, I've labeled up here Saturn, Neptune, the dotted line is Jupiter, and the Earth in this histogram. Now, we're starting to fill in down here, but this is where all the effort's going. These things are dime a dozen. They're kind of vermin, in fact. It's like you find them and you go, oh, God, another Jupiter, crap. And you're really looking for the low-mass stuff. So all the pushes in precision, all the pushes of increasing radial velocity precision, of increasing the precision of transits, playing the game of getting our microlensing techniques really refined, is to push these techniques down to these low masses. Now, you'll notice I've drawn this line here. I've used the word incomplete. Because our methods are very insensitive, our censuses are kind of crude right now. So this is not the true distribution of masses. There's probably a lot more stuff down here. But we're only now beginning to break into this low-mass zone that really interests us, the so-called Earths. Transit methods are just now, literally in the last few months, have broken through the Earth-sized barrier. Just at the end of December and November, we got the first announcements of really believable candidate Earth-sized planets. Whether they're Earth mass remains to be seen, but it's pretty plausible. Microlensing is certainly very promising for doing that, but we're still a few years away. It's going to take us about 5-6 years to get a new network of telescopes going that will be able to do this experiment in some detail. The Koreans are, South Koreans are investing a huge amount of money in this. They've got a $30 million project to build 3 telescopes in the Southern Hemisphere that we, Ohio State, are involved in. We're building the cameras for those telescopes. So first of those is going to get deployed in late 2013, and then each of the telescopes will come online about 6 months after that. So by 2015, we should have the Koreans should have the network up on its feet, and we should start getting the first results. But it will take a few years before that happens. So I want to end on some results from the Kepler mission. Kepler was launched a couple of years ago. It was 2007. It was put up in orbit. It's watching a patch of the sky near the constellation of Cygnus, and its mission is to search for planetary transits. It can measure the brightnesses of stars with absolutely superb accuracy. A part in 100,000 is fairly typical. And it looks at them quickly enough that it should be able to see a transit by a fairly small object in front of a sun mass star or smaller. Smaller the star, the more of it you block, the bigger the effect, the easier it is to see. So here's a couple of just quick snapshots of recent Kepler results. The Kepler 20 system was one of the first real big blockbuster multi-planet systems found. It's got 5 planets. 2 of them, Kepler 20e and Kepler 20f, are comparable in size to the Earth and around a G-star. Our sun is a G-star. Great. However, these things are inside the radius of habitability. So these things are too hot. These are hot planets. KOI, Kepler Object of Interest, number 961. Kepler has nearly 2,000 objects of interest right now. These are objects that are nearly confirmed to be planets but still need more data. Found 3 planets very close to an M star, red dwarf, but closer than the habitable zone. But what's exciting about those, this just came out a couple weeks ago, is they're down to Mars size. So they've got Earth, sub-Earth, and now down to Mars-size objects being found in Kepler. Cool. This is really great. The problem is Kepler 20 and KOA 961 are hot planets. They're too close to their parent stars for stable water, so they're not in the habitable zone. But we're getting really, really close. We've gotten the sensitivities down now in these experiments. We can actually detect Earth-sized planets. But our initial sensitivity are going to be those that are very close to the parent star because they have the biggest eclipse probability, transit probability, and they orbit more quickly, which means I will see more transits in a short period of time and confirm their existence. An Earth transit around its parent star will make a part in 100,000 dip, part in 10,000, a few 10,000 dip, but it only does it once a year. So you've got to watch for many years to build up enough data to confirm that it's going to happen. This is the first real habitable zone planet that's come out of the Kepler mission, Kepler 22b. First, in the bottom here is our solar system showing the habitable zone, Venus, Earth, and Mars. They're using the, by the way, it should not surprise you that Kepler, because they want to find the first planet bona fide in the habitable zone, is using the optimistic version of the habitable zone, not the conservative. You always got to hedge your bets. But Kepler 22b, by the optimistic definition of habitable zone around parent star, it's a slightly cooler than G star, slightly cooler than the sun, in fact, has an orbit here very close to the inside of the optimistic habitable zone. Now, it's a super Earth. It's a way bigger place than the Earth. That could be problematic. A super Earth has stronger gravity, can build and hold onto a heavier atmosphere. Heavier atmospheres have a higher greenhouse potential, so this thing could in fact be a Venus world. It's awfully close to its internal planet. I back off my requirement for habitable zone. Remember, habitable zone is defined in terms of an Earth planet. That's a super Earth. Kind of a stretch, but so it goes. This is one of those fun planets. This was the one that came out that was called Tatooine. This is, in fact, a 0.3 Jupiter mass planet orbiting a binary star system. It's got 2 suns that turn around in its sky as it goes around. I mention this because it's cool. Half of stars are binaries. And some of those binaries, if they're tight enough, can have stable planets. This one, unfortunately, is nowhere near the habitable zone. But here's the exciting bit. These are the candidates, the ones that have not yet been confirmed. These are the lower temperature limit and the upper temperature limit for their optimistic definition of habitable zone. These are all the candidates they've got as of December of last year. That's a lot. There's an awful lot of planets in the next few years have a real potential to be Earth-sized. They're getting down. This is Earth-sized down here. So these are all super-Earths, but they're in their habitable zone. They're starting to get down to really interesting sizes. So I expect in a couple of years, we're going to find the first Earths in an Earth-like orbit around its parent star. It's really getting close and exciting. So the bottom line here is the hunt is still on for the Earth-like planets, and we're going to talk about those tomorrow. We keep going along looking for new of these things, and the real goal is to try to find those that are capable of harboring life. We call those exo-Earths, and we'll talk about those tomorrow.